May it please the court, Peter Adolph for Antonio Rivera-Cruz. Mr. Cruz's prior Oklahoma conviction was not for a crime of violence. The government's contention that it was is wrong for two reasons. First, when it is considered categorically, the common law-based crime of assault and battery, as it's defined under Oklahoma law, is not a crime of violence. That much the government concedes. But in this case, there simply is no other permissible way to consider the statute. It can only be considered categorically. The modified categorical approach does not apply, has no reason to be. That's the first reason. The second reason, which the government apparently also conceded yesterday in the supplemental brief, is that while there are certain circumstances in which a court may consider beyond the statute what sort of particular facts were necessarily admitted by the defendant as part of the plea, in this case there are no such facts. This was a nolo contendere plea. The defendant specifically did not admit anything beyond the bare elements of the offense. And therefore there simply are no other facts to consider. First, regarding how the statute is to be considered categorically. The elements of assault and battery have been the same since the time of the common law. In many states, they still are purely a common law formulation. In Oklahoma, that formulation has been incorporated verbatim into a statute. But the language is the same, the elements are the same. As far as the degree of force that is required, it is simply an unwarranted type and nothing more. That is what the Supreme Court was dealing with in the Johnson case, and the Supreme Court found categorically when one is dealing with a common law type traditional assault and battery, it cannot be considered a crime of violence. That is the same determination that this court followed after that in the United States versus White when it decided that the Virginia common law assault on a domestic partner or domestic person cannot be considered a crime of violence for purposes of 922G9.
Well, how do you reconcile Harcum, then, with that argument?
Judge, the Supreme Court in Johnson has simply held it. And candidly, there have been, as we described in the brief, there have been various statements and dicta in a number of cases going back for many years. But all of that was abrogated by Johnson versus the United States, as this court recognized as far as the modified category in Band.
Well, Band, though, dealt with a divisible statute, right?
It did.
So it didn't really address this issue. And there's a long line of cases involving this very common law offense, but we have said that there's no bar to using the modified categorical approach under these circumstances. We're just completely wrong on that.
That it's not that this court is wrong about that. The court, in fact, recognized where the modified categorical approach is appropriate in Band. If I may quote from, and to be clear,
the problem. But I think, as Judge Diaz has indicated, it's unclear how much Band helps you because of the factual predicate. Van did involve a divisible circumstance. We don't have that here. So going back to Van doesn't really, I don't think, adequately respond to a question which I share.
Well, I believe actually that Van does because of the entire assumption of Van, that there would be no point in any of the Van things if it were a simple matter of if you had a statute that could be violated in many ways, going back and trying to look at what the actual conduct was. Because Van may have involved a divisible statute, but all members of the court who participated in that opinion agreed that it was only divisible into two. Now, the Van opinion itself and the case law underlying talked about how one can violate the indecent liberty statute in North Carolina in dozens of ways, some of which are named in case law, some of which are not. But there are many ways to violate the statute. But this conduct-specific approach is exactly what the Johnson case prohibited going forward. And the Van court recognized that. And if I may, the plurality opinion, I guess it was, set that out in the I think, the clearest possible way. And that was also the opinion that Your Honor Judge Wynn joined and that Your Honor Judge Diaz joined. When the plurality, the five-judge plurality, wrote that the point of the modified categorical approach, and I quote, is to determine, subject to constitutional restrictions, which prescribed criminal behavior in a disjunctively worded statute form the basis of the defendant's conviction. And that same opinion went on to say, the issue whether we may apply the modified categorical approach depends on an examination of the different criminal elements of a statute and on the stated behaviors that these elements prescribe, not on any particular conduct that may be encompassed by given statutory description. The single offense of indecent liberties, as set forth in the North Carolina statute, can qualify as a violent felony, which is the specific section of issue in that case, depending on which of the statute's alternative elements are satisfied in a particular case.
The Supreme Court in Johnson, though, didn't consider Shepherd documents because there weren't any. It found that there was nothing in the record that would have permitted the district court to conclude that the conviction rested on anything other than the least objectionable offense there. It didn't suggest, as I read Johnson, that it wouldn't have resorted to such had they been available, did it?
I really don't think that that is in dispute in this case. In fact, the Solicitor General...
could you go back and answer my question?
I'm sorry.
There is that distinction between this case and Johnson in that, as I recall, the Supreme Court in Johnson didn't suggest that it wouldn't have looked to Shepherd-approved documents had they been available.
I believe, Judge, that the description of the modified categorical approach in Johnson was because there was a divisible statute, and the court said that the modified categorical approach that is looking to other documents could be used to determine which of those three. And then the court went on to say there are no such documents in this case, and therefore we look to the least culpable conduct, which that subsection by itself, that single set of elements, is identical to the statute that we have here.
My question, though, which you've sort of glossed over, is that there are such Shepherd-approved documents? There were no Shepherd-approved documents that the Supreme Court could have looked at there, which is why they didn't look at them.
That's true, Your Honor.
So it doesn't give you as much comfort, I think, as you initially suggested, where there are Shepherd-approved documents.
Judge, again, any Shepherd-approved documents the Supreme Court, I think, made clear in Johnson, would only have been used to figure out which set of elements within the statute they were looking at. And as it happens, fortunately for us, the set of elements they ended up looking at is the exact same set of elements we have here. There is no question that there is prior law from this court that suggests, whether it be in dicta or sometime in holdings, going back to cases that the government cites, that if you have even in a statute with a single set of elements, that one can look beyond that to find the underlying specific conduct. But it is the specific conduct approach that the Supreme Court foreclosed in Johnson and this court adopted.
Well, but the Supreme Court cited our decision in Sims, did it not? And Sims, as I recall, involved an application of the modified categorical approach to a Maryland battery statute that didn't specifically enumerate different types of conduct either.
It's true, Your Honor, that the Supreme Court cited many cases. That one was in the Strim site. And all I can say is that I don't believe that elevates it to a holding of the Supreme Court. And I would add that
it at least explains what the Supreme Court was considering as a possible, an appropriate vehicle for the application of the modified categorical approach.
Well, Judge, looking back at the Johnson case and what the state of litigation was at the time, that view was not actually being argued before the court. In fact, the Solicitor General in their brief, I believe it's page 42 of their brief, specifically said that in describing what the modified categorical approach would be applied in that Johnson case, that would be available to distinguish between the three sets of possible elements in that case, not to go beyond it in the unitary statute. And that was the background that Johnson decided on. That view, I don't believe, was really in controversy in the Johnson case. That was the government's position as well. That's why the government was arguing for something broader and something different. They were asking the court to go to a fact-specific approach, and the court did not do that.
Well, I guess the bottom line here, though, is as interesting as this argument may be, I don't know that it doesn't matter here, right? Because ultimately, even if we look at Shepard-approved documents from your perspective, the government loses.
That's correct.
So why do we have to decide this very interesting but otherwise academic issue?
Besides the fact that we all enjoyed the discussion so much.
Thank you, Ron. I guess the content of the remand and the reasons behind it may be less important than the result, certainly Mr. Cruz. Certainly this is still an issue that there's lots of discussion about, and I think we certainly went on both grounds, and I think the government has essentially conceded both of them. I also do think it's clear from the Johnson case and from all of the different opinions in Van that. All of those cases.
I'm glad to see you found clarity in Van, because I don't know that any of us have yet.
Well, Judge, there wasn't a lot that all 12 of the judges, including Your Honor, participated and agreed on. But that was actually one thing that the court did seem to agree on across the board, including the dissenters, was that what the purpose of the modified categorical approaches and what its limitations.
And Judge Duncan is smiling because she wasn't on that panel.
I see my yellow light is on. I guess at this point, I would just, unless the court has further questions, I'd like to give it to my room.
That's fine. Thank you. Mr. Edwards?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Richard Edwards for the United States. As Your Honors have already identified, Johnson is the controlling case here. And in Johnson, we need to first, if I may, back up and look at what the issue really was, and what the state of the law and the split in the circuits. As this court in Wright, its published decision in Wright, noted, there was a split in the circuits. And that's what Johnson was addressing. And as this court also noted, Johnson eventually, towards the end, endorsed the approach this court had taken and continues to take by citing, it might be in a street site, but it had private places, the first case, the Sims opinion from this court. In Johnson, the question, as the court has noted, the question was whether under the Florida statute, a touching, because they had to look at, as Your Honor has identified, they had to look at the least offensive of those. And as Justice Scalia's majority opinion notes in its very first sentence, the question was whether the Florida felony offense of battery by actually and intentionally touching was a violent felony. That was the issue. There was a lengthy discussion there of the fact that the government in that case, according to the opinion, the government was taking the approach that that should be per se, categorically, a crime of violence, that any touching whatsoever. That, I would note, would be a position contrary to what this court has been holding since the Coleman en banc opinion, Kirksey Sims. That has not been the position in this. So the government was going beyond, because the government recognized for more than two decades that mere touching cannot categorically, in our circuit, be a crime of violence. That was the issue, however, in Johnson. And the Johnson opinion held, no, mere touching cannot be enough categorically. And we have never contested that categorically these assault and battery common law crimes are crimes of violence.
So if we determine that the categorical approach applies, then that's the end of this, from your perspective.
That is correct, Your Honor. If this court were to conclude that this court could only apply the categorical approach, the government loses. To do so, however, this court would have to ignore or find some way to overturn or get around not just an unbroken string of cases, but 10 opinions by this court since Johnson, 5 published, 1 argued and then in that appendix, and 4 unpublished, recurring opinions. 10 opinions, though, including in five published, that have continued in applying Johnson to say that for these common law assault and battery, where mere touching to do, modified categorical approach is appropriate. That is the law in this circuit as Johnson has applied. I would also like to point out, in answer to Judge Duncan's question to Mr. Hale, it was not just in Johnson that the court talked about the possibility that maybe modified categorical approach would work. In fact, towards the end of the majority opinion, citing in particular the concerns that the dissent and Justice Alito had come up with, they said that in trying to decide whether this one issue, whether touching was a violent felony, that the modified categorical approach would apply. That they basically, I was going to say poo-poo, I don't think you use that at the Supreme Court. They were basically, though, saying that the government and Justice Alito's dissent were overreacting and saying, well, the government will never be able to get convictions for a common law assault and battery if they have used modified categorical approach. And the court said, of course you can, see U.S. v. Sims. The court endorsed modified categorical approach. What the defense is asking here, as I say, is for this court to ignore five published post-Johnson opinions, all of which are cited in our brief, except for this court's opinion in U.S. v. Taylor, which was decided October 24th, 2011.
I want to make sure I'm following you. You said something about getting a conviction for, the government would never be able to get a conviction for it. Of course, we're not talking about getting a conviction for anything here. This is only for purposes of enhancement. And I know you know that, but at least in terms of where we are, why would we not seek that which is simple? I mean, in an instance like this, do you concede that this is, that the Oklahoma statute involves a single set of elements?
It involves a single set of elements, but those elements can be satisfied in numerous ways, just as in Taylor and Shepard, the Supreme Court's case. There might have only been one element, but it could be satisfied different ways. Was it a breaking into a dwelling? Was it breaking into a boat?
So we don't get to take the simple approach and look at these things that would make life so much easier for everybody. If it's a single set of elements, we'll do categorical. If we got the or situation where you can have either that or that, and you don't know which one he was actually convicted on, you then look at the Shepherd documents. It seems to be just a simple, nice, easy way would avoid us having to go through every one of these little cases with you guys when you come up here. Of course, it's a big deal to the defendant because it kicks up a sentence that, oh man, really, really goes up in the stratosphere when you get into these enhancement things.
And I agree, Your Honor, life could be a lot simpler and all of us would have other things we could work on. However, that's not what the law is, and neither the Supreme Court nor binding precedent from this circuit allows us to do that. And what the defendant is asking for here, and I think this merits mention, what the defendant is asking for here is for this panel to decide that common law assault and battery cannot be a crime of violence. Categorically, it is not a crime of violence, because if you do not apply modified categorically, if you do not apply that approach, we're only left with categorical. And categorically, we agree it is not a crime. It is, we can't categorically say it is a crime of violence. So there's two extremes here. Categorically, it is categorically a crime of violence. That is not the law of this circuit. And post-Johnson, it can't be the law anywhere. The other extreme, it is categorically not a crime of violence. So an assault and battery committed by stabbing somebody, by beating them after death, categorically, it's just not a crime of violence. Neither of those approaches is the law. After Johnson, and it never was in this circuit, but especially after Johnson, it's not the law anywhere that categorically it is a crime of violence. It is not the law anywhere that I have found in any circuit that it is categorically not a crime of violence. So the middle ground, complicated though it is, has to be the root. And I would point out that Justice Alito said in his dissent in Johnson, almost half the states. My math might be different. I added it up. In his opinion, he cites 27 states and the District of Columbia, including every state in our circuit, plus the Oklahoma statute. So basically what the defense is asking for is for this court to do the extraordinary, and I submit radical approach of saying, contrary to all of our precedent, including the five post-Johnson published opinions, contrary to Johnson, and contrary to, or at least without support from any other circuit, we are going to hold that categorically, common law assault, which can be a fatal beating. No, categorically, categorically not a crime of violence. There, and it cannot have been Congress's intention, because the court's holding here is going to apply not just to illegal reentry cases, but as we all agree, this is pretty much the same definition under the force clause for armed career criminal, for 922G, for career offender provision.
So that sounds like it would really be a bad thing. You know, you just categorically say assault can't be a really harsh beating. But there are different types of assault that you can charge someone with. I mean, if you pull out a gun and you assault, there's a different charge there, and it's not a simple assault. And the problem is a simple assault can go to the range of it. And wouldn't you think that if you decided that you wanted to use this for some higher purpose, you would charge the higher level of assault to ensure that the violence element is something that can be used for enhancement later? But if you're going to just throw out, just like you do, you know, well, he was, it's a really bad offense, but we're just going to throw in a little simple assault. I mean, that's kind of what flows when you go with a little charge like that. And in this instance, the only thing that kind of makes it that way is it's upon an officer. It's assault upon an officer. And then, I mean, but it's a simple assault. Is that right?
Your Honor, respectfully, I would disagree with you. First of all, to answer it, and if I may, in order,
sure.
Your questions. First of all, of course, the situation we in federal court are facing is not what charging decisions we could have brought. We are at the mercy of our colleagues in the state right. DA's office.
Oh, I'm totally with that, but you don't get the benefit of trying to make the law what you want it to have been for the state. You are stuck with what they did. And that's what you want to do. You want to. I'm with you. You didn't get to make that charge. So what is your thing? The problem is, you got to use what they did, though. That's the problem. I totally agree. It's not your fault. If you could have done it, sure, you would have charged the greater because you wanted to use it later on for enhancement. They are thinking about taking care of their case, and you want to use their case, not the one you would have done. You're not entitled to use the case you would have done. So you're not being penalized. You just haven't used what you got.
But, Your Honor, to continue on that theme, first of all, I don't purport to know what the law is in all 27 states that have this common law assault and battery. What else would be available? You know, obviously, in a situation where a weapon is used, almost every state has some kind of assault with a deadly weapon, assault with a deadly kill. Nonetheless, if it is just a fist beating, which likewise would be nearly fatal, given the breadth of a felony assault and battery, not a simple assault, I would suggest, but a felony assault and battery, given that what this court has referred to as the overbreadth of this kind of statute, that it could be from this to that, that's why the modified categorical approach is appropriate. Because Your Honor is absolutely right. It could be somebody's mad at a neighbor and taps him on the shoulder and says, back off. Or it could be, I beat my neighbor and put him in a coma. Either one could be with my variance. Either one could be charged as a assault and battery.
But surely the last one could have been charged for something far greater.
It could have been.
And that was the choice the state made.
That's correct.
And you stuck with what the state made. You wish they had charged the greater one, but they didn't do it. But you want the benefit of the greater charge because you say we should now look at every little factual situation and say, oh, he beat the neighbor, so therefore it's a violent. Is that right?
No.
In other words, that's the complicated thing you think we should do.
Your Honor, what I want is the benefit of what the binding case law is from this circuit and from the Supreme Court. And what I want is for this court, where there is an overbroad statute that embodies several generic crimes, what I want is for this court to say, in keeping with its own decisions and Johnson, we have to look at the modified categorical approach in Shepard's doctrine.
Which is not the same as saying a mini trial, just a limited set of documents that we look at all the time.
Absolutely. And
but how does that help you in this case?
And that was the next point, because I do not, I heard the dangerous word that the government has conceded. So I don't.
Yeah, my ears went up on that. I said, boy, this argument is going to be short.
I think the ears of several people from my meeting right went up, too. Who's now in the appellate section of the U.S. Attorney's Office? No, sir. Amen. We did not concede several of the things that we were alleged to have conceded. What we said was, especially in the pleading that was filed yesterday in response to the motion to supplement, we conceded or agreed that a NOLO plea in and of itself, which was the fact here, a NOLO plea in and of itself cannot be the acceptance of responsibility and admission of the facts that a straight guilty plea can be if you have a plea colloquy. for example. That can't be in dispute. That's what we have here. But what we disagree with, and this is why, with regard to Judge Diaz's question, this is why we did not lose automatically because of the no-go plea. What Shepard said, and what the cases I cited yesterday in my pleadings say, is there are a variety of Shepard-approved documents. They don't use that term, of course, in Shepard, but there's a variety. From which we are allowed to glean which variety, in a modified categorical approach, which kind of crime it was.
Well, not what kind of crime, there's only one kind of crime. What you want to find out is which set of facts support this crime. Is that right? You're not looking for a different category of crime. You are looking for a set of facts that supported this one crime.
Facts insofar as they are in Shepard-approved documents.
Yes. I just want to make sure we are, because if you're looking for, in the OAR situation, you're actually looking for a different category of a crime. In this instance, you have one crime. And it has one set of elements. What you are looking for with those Shepard documents, as I understand what you're saying, is we should look to see if what the facts are that supported that one crime, how they differ. Were they facts that would support violence, or were they facts that would support nonviolence, but the crime is still the same, correct?
It is statutorily the same, but it can be committed in various ways, correct? Just as in Taylor and Shepard. And as far as looking at the facts, because to hear the defendant tell it in his pleas, facts are like kryptonite. You got to stay away from the facts. Well, actually, no, that's not the law. As this court has held in Coleman, Shepard, Arkham, Kirksey, Sims, Taylor, White, you are allowed to look at some of the facts. In fact, in Shepard, they looked at the facts. They looked at the facts that were in the Shepard group documents. And in this court, for example, in Sims, as Your Honor has mentioned previously, in Sims, the facts they looked to were the charging documents that said the defendant battered somebody. In White, as I recall, it was that the defendant had assaulted somebody. The facts are there.
Well, but in all of those cases, we're dealing with, I think, with straight-up guilty pleas. And, of course, you're well aware of the case law that says we can't, in an Alford plea context, rely on Shepard-approved documents. What is the difference here?
Your Honor, I would, again, respectfully disagree with you. Alston did not say we cannot rely on Shepard-approved documents. What Alston said, and I got sidetracked, to go back to the question with regard to what you asked, Shepard held, and this court has held since then, that there's a variety of Shepard-approved documents. There is the charging document, there is the plea colloquy, there is admissions made by the defendant, there's findings of fact, there are verdict sheets, whatever.
Okay, I think you're about to say that we can't rely on the plea colloquy in an Alston, the Alford case.
But suppose in the disjunctive, it says the court can rely on the charging document or just narrow down the plea colloquy. Let's just focus on those two. In Alston, the facts were the charging document was worthless for this question. The charging document just mouthed the words of the statute. It said he committed an assault, second degree murder assault. So the charging document doesn't give us any. So
did we analyze the charging document? I guess
only to the extent of saying that
doesn't help.
Just repeats the statute doesn't help.
Okay.
So the government's saying, yeah, but the Alford plea colloquy helps. And what Alford holds is, I'm sorry, what Alston holds is, no, that's the only other choice you got here because your charging document didn't get you anywhere. So what about the admissions of the defendant time of plea? But an Alford plea, by definition, he's not anything. So you can't get there either way. But, as I cited a case from the Second Circuit, and just last night I found another case, which I apologize I don't have, from this circuit, noting that where the category is not an issue, where there were, for example, strict categorical crime violence, even an Alford plea qualifies. Even an Alford plea, because we don't need the defendant's admission if the charging document makes it clear that this was a crime. What the defendant argued, and what prompted my pleading yesterday, what the defendant argued in his legal analysis accompanying his motion 2 days ago, what he argued was, it's got to be both. You can't even look at the charging document unless the defendant also admits at the time of the guilty plea. And that's not what the law is. It's not what the law is in this circuit. It's not what the law is in the Second Circuit. I can't stand here and tell you, but I cannot imagine it's the law in any circuit. So to go back, ultimately, as I promised I would, to your question, We do not concede that we lose, regardless of whether the modified categorical applies or not, because while the NOLO plea cannot get us across the finish line, the charging instrument does, because the charging instrument makes it clear that of the variety of assaults that were involved here, this was not a mere touching. This was headbutting of a police officer, and that is a crime of violence.
And a NOLO plea is a plea to the charging instrument, or simply a recognition that the government has sufficient evidence to proceed on something?
A NOLO plea, in the state of Oklahoma at least, a NOLO plea has all the legal effect of a guilty plea, but for certain civil consequences. Now, in a NOLO plea, obviously the defendant does not have to stand there and say, yes, I did that, I did that, I did that. Obviously, that's what's inherent in the NOLO plea. What he does say, however, is, as the literal translation is, I do not choose to contend. I do not fight.
Well, you know, the problem, and I see where you're going with it. I think you're making good points on it. But I'm trying to understand that the basis of a NOLO plea, the reason the government, get back to allowing him to do this, is because he doesn't have to admit to anything. He's only saying there's enough out there. It could have been I touched it. And that's all that's necessary, so I will plead guilty to this assault. It clearly is not an admission to everything that's in that charging document, I would think, not a NOLO plea. If you want that, then the government would say, I'm not taking your NOLO plea. I'm going to proceed to trial and get a guilty verdict on it. Then you got it. But if you choose to take a NOLO plea, all you got is don't you just have the minimum? Because that's all that's necessary. Sort of the basis for doing it, isn't it? I mean, a NOLO. You go in and, you know, you've got someone who says, well, there's something out there I can be convicted of, but I'd rather not deal with it. I can do a NOLO, ball game's over.
I don't know what the case management policies of the Tulsa DA's office were in 2002, Your Honor. But what I do know is this, that the NOLO plea, as Your Honor quite accurately points out, the NOLO plea doesn't help us at all as far as figuring out what the defendant admits to. What I'm saying is we don't have to, that's not all we're based on. This is not a situation, as Alston was, where we had to look at what the defendant was admitting to, and under an Alford plea in Alston, that doesn't get us there. Let me, if I may, just
pause. But before we leave, it would seem to me that the reason you kind of want to have the things that admitted to, because you avoid having this mini trial. You avoid having to then go and litigate, well, was it a headbutting or was it just a touching? I mean, isn't that kind of the basis? If you plead guilty, oh, we don't have to worry about it. You plead guilty to this thing. Everything there is done. It's admitted. Isn't that sort of the basis when you're dealing with Shepard? That's why it's limited to Shepard-approved documents, because if you didn't have the Shepard-approved document, you could bring in somebody off the street and says, hey, let me tell you what really happened here. But you can't do that. You can only use that's what's there in the Shepard-approved situation with the admitted one. And in the NOLO, you say, no, we can use, it's almost like using extra evidence beyond that which is admitted. A sort of a mini trial.
Your Honor, the red light's consistent.
Please respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. The NOLO plea, again, doesn't get us there. I admit that. However, under the modified categorical approach, it's clear that we are allowed to move this charging document. And if I may just make one more sentence, Your Honor, if the situation were reversed, just random level reverses, if the defendant had pled NOLO to assault with intent to kill and inflicting grievous bodily injury, assuming that's an Oklahoma statute, the NOLO plea is of no moment because categorically, that's a crime of violence. We don't care the level to which he admits anything. Here, under the modified categorical approach, we look at the charging document. It was headbutted. It's a crime of violence. It's not a capping. And so, likewise, we don't need, it'd be nice, but we don't need the defendant's admission. It doesn't have to be this and that, as they would have. It has to be this or that. And this, in this case, is the charging document. Thank you,
and I appreciate Thank you. May it please the court. I guess I'd just start with the last thing the counsel talked about and again with the headbutting, and I think counsel inadvertently may have given a great example of why the mini-trial concept would be such a problem. The facts the government attempted to rely on at the trial level in this case which are contained in the PSR and which we contested, but this is what we, would be decided if we were on remand and litigating that issue, that apparently the defendant was in the back of a patrol car with strain while the car was in motion, and the headbutting apparently was hitting his head against the back of an officer's car seat or the partition. In other words, it wasn't even a touching the way we think of a touching at all. It was a constructive touching. It was the transmission of force from his head through another object, startling the officer. The government worries that apparently more serious cases are out there, that the world is full of defendants who were committed serious assault but were convicted under simple assault. The simple answer is Oklahoma has an aggravated assault on a police officer statute, Section 750, which has all the same elements, but adds the element of great bodily injury. And if he had been charged and convicted under that statute, there would be no need to look at whether it was a NOLA plea or a regular plea. There would be no need to look at Shepard documents. It would be categorically crime involved.
Is Mr. Edwards correct when he says that in Alston, all that we did was limit the universe of acceptable or non-acceptable Shepard documents to the plea colloquy, but otherwise did not suggest that we couldn't consider the charging instrument, for instance, in a case involving an Alford plea? Is that right?
Judge, I believe there were a wide range of possible questions that were being answered with a single answer. The ultimate question is, for a court examining a judgment years and decades later, what were the elements of the offense? Permissible to go beyond that. What were the elements of the offense that the defendant necessarily admitted to as part of that plea? There are certainly cases in which a NOLO plea could yet, the court could still look at the charging document. That would be a case, for instance, like Van. In Van, we had two possible separate elements, sets of elements. And in that case, even if it were a NOLO plea, and we had an indictment to charge just one subsection, in that case, subsection 2, then that would have been a crime of violence, because that set of elements is per se a crime of violence. And because the defendant necessarily admitted to those bare elements, that would be enough. That's not what we have in this case or in any statute that does not have different sets of elements. There's no need to, there's no permissibility to go back to an indictment to clarify something which needs no clarification. The elements are what they are. It's an unwanted touching of a police officer performing his or her duty.
If the NOLO plea doesn't prevent a court from looking at the charging documents, then we get back to, it seems to me, the problem that I have with White, and the fact that, at least in this circuit, we haven't limited resort to the modified categorical approach to a statute with divisible components, as some circuits have. Could you help me with that?
Yes, Your Honor, and the government certainly can cite five cases. I cited, I think, three or four going in different directions on this in the pre-Johnson and immediately post-Johnson. However, this court in Clay recognized for the first time that that was an open question. And that was just over a year ago. In the Clay opinion, that was dealing with escape and the different forms of escape and what could be used. And that was a footnote 4 in the Clay opinion. The court said, they recognized without deciding that the defendant in that case was making the same argument they're making here, which is that Johnson foreclosed the use of the modified categorical approach for a unitary statute with a single set of elements. And it declined to decide that it did not treat the issue as settled. Clay recognized that Johnson may or may not have changed the law, left that issue open, and that is what the Van Court said. That is what all of the 12 judges, including Your Honor and Your Honor, participating in Van, recognized, was that if you have two subsections, you may look beyond the statute to figure out which of the two subsections the defendant was necessarily convicted of. If you have one set, that's the end.
Well, that's essentially, too, what we said in Rivers.
It is. And Rivers is arguably in tension with other contemporaneous decisions and other decisions that predate Vance. And that is the one thing that we're going for. that's all.
Thank you very much. We will, I will ask the clerk to adjourn court for the day, and we will come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned. Renee Dye. God save the United States and this honorable court.